You want to know why we pay so much attention to the Federal Reserve? Well, here's why.
Price stability is the responsibility of the Federal Reserve and serves as the bedrock of our economy.
The bedrock, gang. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday, today the 21st of September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The news up front, just to get it on the record in case somehow you haven't heard yet. The Federal Reserve raised interest rates again today, another 0.75 percentage point, just about what everybody had been guessing. And Chair Jay Powell said they're going to keep on raising until inflation is well and truly dead. So question number one at Powell's press conference today was, so how are you going to know it's time to stop?
We'll be looking at a few things.
Well, yeah, but what?
First, we'll want to see growth continuing to run below trend.
To be clear, growth below trend, that's the economy just growing slower than it usually does, which is about 2% or so. What else, though, Jay?
We'll want to see movements in the labor market showing a return to a better balance between supply and demand.
Supply and demand in the labor market, that's that two job openings for every job seeker thing we have been telling you about for months now. But that can't be all he's looking for, though, right?
And ultimately, we'll want to see clear evidence that inflation is moving back down to 2%.
We are, of course, a very long way from that 8.3% at the most recent reading. Here, though, is the thing.
Monetary policy does famously work with long and variable lags.
That's a Milton Friedman joke, by the way, the long and variable lags thing. But look, the Fed has already raised rates a full 3 percentage points, literally 0% to 3% after today's hike in 6 months. That is a lot, and it's fast. And I point it out as a way to set up this.
The way I think of it is our policy decisions affect financial conditions immediately. In fact, financial conditions have usually been affected well before we actually announce our decisions.
We talked about that, right? Things like mortgage rates going up before the Fed actually raises its rates. But those financial conditions, we should say, do take just a little while to play out.
Then changes in financial conditions begin to affect economic activity fairly quickly within a few months.
And then we get the long and variable lag.
But it's likely to take some time to see the full effects of changing financial conditions on inflation.
Which gets us, at very long last, to this.
As the stance of policy tightens further, it will become appropriate to slow the pace of rate hikes while we assess how our cumulative policy adjustments are affecting the economy and inflation.
Wait, sorry, one more thing. Actually, it is the $64,000 question here.
No one knows whether this process will lead to a recession, or if so, how significant that recession would be. That's going to depend on how quickly wage and price inflation pressures come down, whether expectations remain anchored, and whether, you know, also do we get more labor supply, which would help as well.
All right. So here's a couple of data points just to flesh out what the Fed is thinking. Core inflation by the end of this year, that takes out food and energy, of course, 4.5%. Unemployment the next couple of years, 4.4% in 2023 and 2024. It was 3.7% in August. If you were looking to Wall Street to get a sense of what Powell said today means, well, first of all, never do that. And B, traders were confused. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Okay, new topic, and I mentioned this real quick at the end of the program yesterday, that Gap is going to cut about 500 corporate jobs at its offices in San Francisco and New York and over in Asia. Peloton, HBO Max, Wayfair, lots of companies are laying people off, and we report on those layoffs as they happen, company by company. But sometimes you do need that big picture view to know what's really going on. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab has it.
There's a natural reason why layoffs grab our attention, says Betsy Stevenson, an economist at the University of Michigan.
Stories always resonate with us because it's scary. It's scary to be laid off. It's scary to lose your job.
It's also scary when the narrative is a recession might be coming. So naturally, everyone's eyes are peeled for bad news. There are practical reasons why we look at layoffs, too.
That can be one of the ways in which we get access to this data fastest.
Company announcements are immediate, while bigger picture numbers from the Labor Department lag by more than a month. The last job openings and labor turnover survey says 1.4 million people lost jobs in July. For reference, Stevenson says the U.S. typically averages somewhere around 2 million lost jobs per month. Plus, layoffs in certain industries, like automobiles, and what car makers say about the job cuts can be good predictors of trouble ahead. Yang Suk Shin is an economist at Washington University in St. Louis.
When things are going bad, people are like, well, you know, I have a car, my car is not perfect, but I don't really need to replace it right now.
Meanwhile, some industries are sometimes too volatile to study piecemeal. In tech, companies tend to expand and collapse quickly. Hospitality always has a lot of turnover. And in general, layoffs are a normal, if unfortunate, part of doing business.
Some firms grow, some firms were productive, but now they lose their market share, then they have to downsize.
And that is especially true now, says Erica Groshen, an economist at Cornell.
This is a very unusual economic time, and nothing's been acting quite like it normally does.
Consumer habits have swung wildly in the last few years. When COVID started, we stopped buying office clothes and started buying exercise equipment. We baked bread and remodeled our houses. Then we dropped our video games and streaming subscriptions to relish in travel and eating out. And behind each of those trends are jobs. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Back in 2008, we all became real familiar with the phrase, too big to fail, right? Financial institutions too important to be allowed to go under, hence billions in government relief. Germans are learning that same phrase today, courtesy of the energy crisis over there. Berlin says it's nationalizing the energy utility Uniper, as it happens the country's biggest importer of natural gas. As Marketplace's Lily Jamali reports, it's not the first major government intervention in European energy markets. And it probably ain't going to be the last.
There's another way to describe Germany's decision to nationalize Uniper.
I'd refer to it as a bailout.
That's Arjun Flora of the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis.
Uniper's a private company, and if this didn't happen, its credit rating would drop and it would effectively become bankrupt.
And Flora says Germany can't afford to let that happen.
Because Uniper has such an important position supplying customers in Germany, so they need to keep the company running.
This summer, Russia responded to Western sanctions by cutting off the flow of natural gas on Nord Stream 1, the largest pipeline between Russia and Europe. Uniper was particularly exposed. It and other natural gas importers have been forced to buy elsewhere and spend a lot more money doing so, which Flora says raises the question.
How many other companies are there in Europe which are really exposed to gas in this way?
At this point, the three largest German importers of Russian natural gas have now gotten bailouts to the tune of 40 billion euros. Meanwhile, France has signaled it plans to take over EDF, its largest utility. And Jason Bordoff at Columbia's Center on Global Energy Policy says more government intervention is likely.
As you head into winter, there's real concerns about whether you're going to have enough energy to heat homes, keep the electricity going for people.
But Bordoff says European governments can't go it alone.
The global energy map, as we know it, is being remade as a result of this crisis.
He says if Europe is going to get through this winter and the next, countries across the continent need to cooperate to help meet all of their energy needs. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
About a month ago now, there was a new rule out from the Biden administration about a specific type of gun sale, ghost gun kits in particular, which with that rule, unlike before the rule, obviously, are subject to the same regulations as other already assembled guns. But Alan Stevens, reported for The Trace that gun sellers are already working around that rule. So we got him on the phone to talk about the ghost gun market and the parts kits that people use to make them.
Ghost gun's a media term, a street term for a privately manufactured firearm. It's a homemade gun, and under congressional law, U.S. citizens who are legally allowed to possess a firearm have long been allowed to make their own guns at home without having to go through background checks or serializations. But
explain serialization, because that's relevant here, right?
Yes, yes. So serialization is something that when you buy a traditional firearm through a regularly licensed gun dealer, there's a serial number attached to that. And what that does is if that weapon ends up at a crime scene down on the line, that serial number and that paperwork allows the federal government and police officers to have an investigative lead. And they call that tracing.
Right.
But these homemade guns, they don't have serial numbers.
Right. So let's talk for a second. And obviously therein lies the problem, right? That is the challenge for tracing these ghost guns, whoever came up with that phrase, right? That is the challenge for law enforcement.
Correct. Yes. It was something that for decades was really something for niche hobbyists. It was very difficult to make a firearm from scratch due to just the gunsmithing skills and material tools necessary.
Right. So let's talk about the gun manufacturing process now as it applies to these ghost guns. It is orders of magnitude easier now than it was decades ago.
Absolutely. That's exactly what happened. So, some very enterprising gun dealers had seized on this allowance in congressional law and said, you know what, we can kind of bring this to the masses. So what they did is they started offering these parts kits, right? And so now you can buy one of these parts kits and, manufacture a complete firearm within under an hour. And if you are a person looking to get a gun illegally outside the purview of the law, this has become a very, great advantage to them.
Important to note here that this is a rule and not a law.
Correct. Yes. So the Biden administration decided they needed to do something about this. And anyone who follows the gun space knows that congressional law regarding gun policy has pretty much been at a stalemate. And so they went through the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives and used their rulemaking capability to try to create regulations on people selling these ghost guns parts kits. But it only applies to the parts kits. So... Right. These dealers, after the rule went into effect, they simply just break up the kits. So you sell each piece individually, and now they're just back in business.
It seems to me this is a story, and look, I don't want to coin a phrase here, right? But this is a story of the administrative state. It is a government regulatory agency using its regulatory powers in its area of concern, but it's uniquely an area where there are ways for the companies and people being regulated to get around it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. The firearms industry has been very powerful, and they've had very powerful lobbying capabilities. In fact, when the Biden administration actually announced that they're going to take on this ghost gun issue almost a year ago, they also, in that same announcement, had to say that they were trying to put in another ATF director because the agency had been nearly directorless for almost 20 mm-hmm, years. Mm-hmm. And part of that was a result of gun dealers and their consistent lobbying through Congress members to kind of put the ATF very much into a corner when it comes to their regulatory capabilities. So even when a lot of these rules and regulations are being made, they're very much being made under the caution and concern of essentially getting pummeled by some very powerful industry lobbying groups.
What do your sources, once you put the pen and paper away, what do your sources at the ATF tell you about the current state of play?
I'm going to keep it real with you. These guys have seen this problem for a very long time. And, there's a lot of disappointment. They don't really talk about the politics, the law enforcement guys. But what they do see is this, that when it comes to this rule, the only thing they think it did was create a lot of fanfare that's, created fear-based sales of more of these parts kits. And, they're telling me that they're assuming that they're going to be picking up more ghost guns in crime scenes as this kind of problem is still being muddled in the White House.
Alon Stevens is an investigative reporter at The Trace. Alon, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up.
If you created one bank, it would get controlled by New York bankers.
Oh, the Fed ain't all about you, New York. First, though, let's do the numbers. Up and down and up and down and up and down. Day on Wall Street today, Dow Industrials lost 522 points, 1.7%, 30,183. NASDAQ down 204, nearly 1.8%, 11,220. The S&P 500 tumbled 66 points, also 1.7%, settled at 3,789. CEOs of major banks testified before Congress today. Of course, the Fed grabbed the big headlines with the announcement it's hiking interest rates again. So let's do some banks, which of course make money on interest consumers pay for loans, but which also lose business if people decide those rates are too high, right? See how that works? Anyway, Bank of America wrote off 2.9% today. Citigroup subtracted 1.9%. JP Morgan Chase wrote off 2.8%. Bond prices were up. The yield on the 10-year T-note, 3.53%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Big speech today from President Biden at the United Nations. Lots of political stuff, of course, as those UN speeches tend to contain. Also, though, a couple of economic headlines, the biggest of which is that the president said the United States is going to commit another $2.9 billion to help reduce food insecurity. That's on top of nearly $7 billion Washington's already promised. The global food crisis, of course, has a bunch of causes. The Russian invasion of Ukraine, related rising energy prices, pandemic supply chain itis, also climate change. So Marketplace's Samantha Fields looked into what more money can and honestly can't get done.
Right now, today, there is more than enough food in the world to feed everyone. David Ortega, a food economist at Michigan State University, says supply isn't the problem.
The global food crisis that we are seeing unfold is really a crisis of affordability and people having access to that food.
Which means humanitarian assistance and foreign aid can make a big difference, he says, especially in countries where people are on the verge of famine, including Ethiopia, Yemen, and Afghanistan.
It's very critical to stress how important it is to get that access to these regions, to these individuals very quickly.
There are more people going hungry or not getting enough nutritious food around the world now than there have been in years, says Caitlin Welsh, with the Global Food Security Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
On the positive side, we've seen an uptick in funding for emergency assistance to the UN World Food Program.
That increased funding is critical, Welsh says, in part because food is more expensive.
And also the costs of humanitarian operations have increased because fuel prices are higher right now.
But as critical as emergency food aid is in the short term,
it's not the solution for long-term food security.
Long-term, climate change threatens the world's food supply, and it is possible that there could come a day when there isn't more than enough food in the world to feed everyone.
The big thing that worries me is this tendency that we all have to take the world for granted, to assume that we have enough food.
William Masters, a professor of food economics at Tufts University, says we have the tools and the knowledge to produce more food and grow crops that are resistant to drought and extreme weather.
If we do deploy the power of science, we can meet human needs even in the face of climate change, even in the face of conflict. We've done it before.
But, he says, it will require sustained investment in science and technology for agriculture to get there. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
If you get a minute today, pull out a dollar bill, would you, and have a look at it. On the left side, as you look at it, George is right, you'll see a black circle with a letter in it. That letter tells you which of the Federal Reserve's 12 regional banks distributed that dollar. For my wallet today, L is the San Francisco Fed, F is Atlanta, and so on. The presidents of those regional banks rotate through the Federal Open Market Committee, the interest rate setting FOMC, I suppose, to give all 12 regions a say in interest rate policy. Five of them voted on today's three-quarter point hike. The thing is, when you look at what parts of the country the regional feds represent, things aren't all that evenly divided. The eastern half of the country is split into eight districts. The western half gets four. New York pretty much gets its own, while on the west coast, one district covers every state west of Colorado, including Alaska and Hawaii. Marketplace's Justin Ho looked into why the Fed's map is so weird.
The answer goes back to 1913, the year the Federal Reserve System was created. Back then, the people who did the creating agreed on one thing.
Everyone figured if you created one bank, it would get controlled by New York bankers.
That's Gary Richardson. He's a professor of economics at UC Irvine, and he was the Fed's first historian between 2012 and 2016. Richardson says people didn't think New York bankers would keep their regional interests in mind when setting interest rates. For instance, farmers in the Midwest often had big mortgages and seasonal incomes, and people in the South wanted to maintain apartheid.
The control of money and finance was an important way that the local white elites maintained control over the poor whites and the African Americans.
So a committee came together and divided the country up into 12 districts. Richardson says the idea was to loosely reflect the regional economies of the time. Big financial hubs got banks, New York and Chicago. Cleveland got one to handle the economy of the Great Lakes region. The West Coast, sparsely populated at the time, got one bank in San Francisco.
You know, Richmond, they can be the specialist in tobacco and financing the tobacco industry. St. Louis, right, they say we need a bank that has expertise in funding the inland waterborne trade of the U.S.
All 12 banks were independent, so they could set their own interest rates. That was great if you wanted a central bank that could set policy based on, say, tobacco seasons. Not so great if you need those banks to work together to stop the entire economy from collapsing.
Some economists have basically blamed the Great Depression on the fact that these regional banks had a lot of power.
Sarah Bender is a professor at George Washington University and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. She says in the early 30s, Congress redesigned the Fed and created the Open Market Committee, or FOMC, to set interest rates for the whole country. Bender says that made the Fed look a lot like it does today.
Now, we still have reserve banks. They still vote on monetary policy. But the system is far more centralized than it was back in 1913.
But the Fed's district map hasn't really changed, even though the economy has, and populations and industries have moved around.
Right, look at North Carolina, like Charlotte, major financial center for the South and Mid-Atlantic and Southeast. But Charlotte doesn't have a reserve bank. Richmond has one, but there really aren't very many big banks in Richmond.
Bender says it's unlikely the Fed's district boundaries will change anytime soon. For one, Congress would have to do it. Bender says the regional banks have tried to make themselves indispensable by specializing.
Kansas City, like going out and sponsoring the Jackson Hole Conference. You know, St. Louis has FRED, the economic and political history data. San Francisco deals with the Silicon Valley finance and so forth.
It might not matter that the Fed's district map is so outdated. The U.S. economy is a lot more integrated than it was in 1913. A farmer in Wyoming might borrow from a lender in Atlanta. As a result,
when you go into FOMC meetings, you do not see that bank presidents vote to represent the needs of the district.
That's Frederick Mishkin, a banking professor at Columbia and a former voting member of the Fed's Board of Governors.
A bank president can vote however they want, but it's recognized by all parties that, in fact, it's not that you should represent the Cleveland district or you should represent the Richmond district or whatever. Your job is to represent the country as a whole.
Mishkin says the regional banks do play a vital role in the Fed's messaging.
When the Fed's doing tough stuff, like it is right now in raising rates, the district banks are very important in terms of generating support for the system. They can talk to major players in their district to make sure that they understand why the Fed is doing what it's doing.
And like in 1913, Mishkin says it's still important to have people outside the Washington-New York bubble making decisions on interest rates. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, I am no Tom Brady fan, not when he was with the Patriots, not now with the Bucks. I'm more of a future Hall of Famer Eli Manning Giants fan. But I gotta say, Tom might be onto something. I saw this on Bloomberg that Brady said on a podcast the other day that he deserves a shorter work week. Brady says, and this is a quote, after working weekends for 23 years, he's going to take Wednesdays off during the NFL season. Work-life balance, am I right? All All righty then, that's another Fed day. Till next time. Here, though, is your moment of context. Walmart announced its holiday hiring plans today. 40,000 seasonal workers it's going to hire, which is a lot, until I tell you that last year, Walmart hired 150,000 people. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Jake Cherry, Drew Jostad, Gary O'Keefe, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Torrado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.